In the New Testament letter to the church in Ephesus, we find a final summary of what a Christian church ought to be. The Apostle Paul is believed to have written this epistle from prison in Rome, and as far as he was concerned, he did not expect that he would make it out alive. He states early on in the letter that while he was indeed a prisoner of the Roman state in body, that in thought and in spirit he was free, having placed himself mentally and spiritually into the care of Christ as what he called a prisoner of the Lord. Sensing that his life may soon be taken from him, he wrote a letter that he intended to be circulated around the churches within that region. And the letter was meant to address certain behaviors and ways of thinking that he hoped would serve as some sort of last will and testament from him to the church that he cared very deeply about. This letter suggests that if a church could act and live in a way that he was proposing, they would have reached spiritual maturity, acting and living as true ambassadors of Christ, as representatives of everything that Paul believed Jesus stood for. Now, Paul was a radical, but this letter to Ephesians is not. And that has led some people to believe that it was not written by Paul personally. It's too conservative for him, that it was written by some of the pro-Paul followers of him. Either way, the text is a response to certain challenges the early church was facing, and these are challenges that have and likely never will go away. Challenges when you get people together with different ideas. So whether Paul or someone else wrote this letter, and I'll assume it was Paul, this is a tremendously important early church document. In Ephesians 4, verse 4, Paul emphasizes that there is only one church. Paul says there are no church divisions. So that means there are no denominations. There are no doctrinal distinctions that divide people, because the church hadn't, in his day, developed those yet. All it meant for Paul, for one to be a Christian, is that you shared, along with all other Christians, one faith and one hope of the resurrection. That's all it meant. In verse 6 of Ephesians 4, Paul writes that there is only one God. And that one God, says Paul, is referred to as the Father of all. Not a God comprising a Father and a Son and a Spirit. The exact Greek reads as follows: one God, Father of all, the one over all, and through all, and in all you. We are called in verse 13 to become, the Greek term is andratelion, or the mature man, the mature person, or the perfect human. So how do we become perfect? Paul says by arriving at the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. You become perfect when you reach the same and full stature of Christ. What he was, you are. Paul is using this example of Jesus as the template, saying that Christ was the first perfect man. And if you wish to be perfect, then following his teachings and example, you measure up to the fullness of his stature. That's an important term. The fullness of the stature of Christ. So if Jesus were God, it would be impossible to arrive at the stature, at half the stature of God. let alone the full stature. Then we see in verse 16, this is a beautiful passage, if only we would let it work in the church today. In the original Greek, it's a bit clumsy when translated directly into English, but it reads like this: the head, the anointed one, out of whom every part of the body being articulated together and being united together through every assimilation of the supply, in accordance with the operation, each part the growth of the body is making into building of itself in love. What Paul is saying is that the source of the unity in the church, the place where it comes out from, the source of love, the ability to connect together and to assimilate ourselves together, is in every case Christ. The unity and love and connectedness that makes us one comes out of where or whom? Not out of ourselves, but from Christ himself. Why is that important? It's important because this is the only way that every part of the body can fit and function together. The parts that seem honorable and the parts that seem less honorable. The parts that believe a certain orthodox doctrine and the parts that believe a different orthodoxy. The parts that are wealthy and have high status and the parts and members who are poor and of low status. The parts that believe in one view of gender equality and the parts that believe in a different definition of equality. The parts that read their Bibles 3 times a day and the parts that never look at their Bibles except in a church service. The parts that believe in one definition of biblical sexuality and the parts that understand morality and human design differently. The parts that were baptized by immersion and the parts that were merely baptized by sprinkling. There are simply too many possible variations of human thought to possibly have unity without Christ, unless you're going to force unity. Unless you're going to force your version of your truth. But that we would call dictatorship, or totalitarianism, or despotism, or tyranny. And that doesn't sound like love and unity, does it? Does it? Because lots of other parts of the church says it does sound like unity and love. Certainly not according to the last will and testament of the Apostle Paul, who was desperately attempting to paint a picture, possibly in his mind the final picture, of what the church ought to be once he was dead and no longer personally able to supervise it, or at least the parts that he had set up. Deep, real peace between the endless variations of human thought is perfectly possible. We just have to stop the people in power trying to make everyone else into mini versions of them. Paul describes the alternative to this articulation of the body, of this joining together through love sourced by him. In verse 17, he says, those who do not allow the unity and love of Christ to permeate the church are like those who are, and in Greek it says, treading according as the rest of the nations, treading in the vanity of the mind of them. He says that the Gentiles, that is the rest of them, walk this way and behave divisively and in controlling ways because their minds are darkened to the knowledge of where unity and connectedness come from. So he's saying, if you act as a church in ways that are divisive and controlling and enforcing your will upon others, if you act that way, you're acting like the Gentiles. You're acting like those who don't claim to be in Christ. You're looking for a source of unity through your power and not through love. And then we read the passage that I want to focus on for the rest of our time today in verse 26. And again, from the Greek, it reads like this. It says, "You are being indignant and you are sinning. The sun, no, let it be on slipping as it falls below the horizon on the vexation of you." Or from the New International Version, "In your anger, do not sin. And don't let the sun go down while you are still angry, and do not give the devil a foothold." I like it better in the Greek. You are being indignant and you are sinning. The sun, no, let it be on slipping on the vexation of you. You just picture the sun slipping behind the horizon. The day is over. All the words that were said and actions done, committed that day are finished. And now you have to sit with this. You have to decide what you do with this hurt feeling, with this offense, whether you gave it or received it. And Paul is saying, if you want to be a healthy church, if you want to be part of something that is solid and filled with Christ, you cannot let this happen. You cannot be people who take down with you at night an ongoing, endless addition of anger and hostility and bad feelings. Paul is saying there's something about unresolved hostility, hatred, animosity, and anger. Anger that is parked and preserved in our minds, that Paul said is like giving a place for the work of the devil. It is the devil's work, real or metaphorical, that divides and works, niggles away at our insecurities, at our self-centeredness, on our egos, to drive us apart. So don't let that happen in the church, says Paul. Stop it before it has a chance to brood and ferment. I remind you again, this is what Paul considers to be the most important things for the church to know. These are his last words as he passionately reflects on the struggles he has seen in the church that may threaten the success and the future of the church as the true body of Christ. And one of the most critical characteristics of a healthy group of people anywhere is that they resolve their differences quickly. And where they cannot, they are quick to forgive. And where necessary, they agree to disagree when there's no other way forward. How different that is from the approach where there's not even a discussion, where there's not even a conversation. There's simply a hierarchical instruction and command for others merely to follow or resist. There is simply no place, says Paul, in God's church for bullying and fragile egos that demand and insist and ferment anger towards those who disagree with them. Don't let the sun set on your anger. It may not always be exactly physically possible within a 24-hour period, but in principle, it is always necessary and possible to make every effort to talk to the people who have offended us or resisted us, and to take steps, sometimes baby steps. And I'm not being unrealistic here. I don't think you can fix everything right away. But to take steps to create as much as you can, and it takes two to tango, to do as much as you can to create an environment in which reconciliation is more likely than it currently is. I think that's fair. I'm not suggesting that if you just go barging into a relationship that contains hurt feelings, that you can just sort it all out. But we can make every effort to take steps to create an environment in which reconciliation is more possible tomorrow than it is today. This theme of unity and holiness being associated is repeated by the author of Hebrews, who states that steps taken towards unity are seriously important acts of authentic Christianity. He says in Hebrews 12:14, make every effort to live in peace with everybody. That is a huge ask. Make every effort to live at peace with everybody. But then he adds this, and be holy. The two are connected. You want to be someone who calls himself or herself holy? You want to be thought of as possessing holiness, the character and likeness of God? Then you have no choice. I have no choice but to make every effort to live at peace with everyone. And then he adds this, without holiness, no one will see the Lord. So he says, there's no point in playing games. There's no point in being a pretend Christian. There's no point in calling yourself a Christian. It's irrelevant. It's not a title. It's how you act. It's how you think. It's who you are or not. Do we do that? Do we make maybe a little effort to live with most people in peace? Do we make a lot of effort and think we're doing enough, but not every effort? Or do we make no effort at all because people just get on our nerves and we can't be bothered? Well, we don't make any effort when we actually choose, or by default don't make any other choice, to just simply harbor offenses and anger and hurt. Do people ever do that? Hang on to their hurt feelings? Or do we all let it go or resolve it before the sun goes down? I think we know the answer. I think we know that most people, at least at times, at least with some people, we hang on to hurt feelings. So I want to explore a few reasons why that might be the case. Some possible responses that lead us into that conclusion that can be increasingly difficult to come out of. The longer we hang on to those things, the more difficult it is to come out of them. First of all, the very obvious answer about why people hang on to hurt feelings is it's easy. It takes no effort. It does take effort to either let them go or make the necessary steps to get them resolved. So, very simply, hanging on to our anger is actually the neutral, automatic, dare I say, lazy response. Secondly, it can also make us feel in control, especially when the other party might want to resolve the issue. Only we can decide that we're not too angry now to talk to the person who hurt us. Even if he or she wants to move past it, they can't get past it until we are good and ready. We can make them feel guilty for hurting us for as long as we want. We have the upper hand in the relationship now, and so now we're going to exploit that advantage by maybe making them suffer and wait in payback for what we have felt. Thirdly, another possible reason might be it allows us to get sympathy from others. And nobody would admit to that. If we're honest with ourselves, though, we have to admit it feels good when people notice us. When someone says that they've noticed we haven't been our usual self for a while, that can make us actually feel very good, the attention. When someone says, what's wrong, maybe we say, oh, nothing, hoping that they'll say, well, no, I think there is something. Keep asking me. And we draw this response from people. It's like a game of emotional cat and mouse. And it gives us the attention we want. At least somebody cares enough to keep asking and not going away when we say nothing is wrong. It shows that they care, and we like that. Fourthly, another reason might be that we don't know how, or we don't want to let things go. We're creatures of habit. We develop superstitions and routines, sometimes without realizing that we do them. If something good happens to us, we keep doing what we've done because it feels good. We may know that we're angry and ignoring the problem, and that definitely isn't the right answer. We know we shouldn't, but we may not know where to begin to address it properly or how. If being angry with people for a long time has become our pattern, and we're able to manipulate the situation until we get what we want, then it must be working for us. And so we do what works. We do what feels good. Why change anything? And especially when we really don't want the anger to go. But the main reason why I think we hold on to our anger is the following. Because we fear that if we could let it go effortlessly, we fear that if we could actually just by the end of the day say that wasn't worth bothering with. Yes, it was offensive. They probably didn't mean it. It was a dumb thing they said or did. I'm going to just let it go. Or I'm going to pick up the phone and say, can we talk about this before the end of the day? Or maybe it's been a few days. Maybe it's been a few weeks. If we could actually have that conversation, then whoever caused the pain in the first place, in our minds, sometimes we may think that they would be getting away with it too easily. If we let them go, if we just said, it's all right, I've forgiven you, let's just not do that again, but I'm not going to hang on to that, we're back to square one. Restored, reconciled, resolved. If we could do that easily, we sometimes feel that the other side is getting off too lightly. Of course, there's zero logic to that. It makes no sense. But if any of us have painful memories that are looping in our head over and over and over, and a long time has passed, even 24 hours, then please consider the truth of that statement, that we may feel that letting that anger go too easily, too lightly, may downplay the importance of what was done or said to us. You see, by holding on to our hurts, we have something of high value. Offenses are useful currency, and we don't like to give it up. They can justify our hostility or our sullenness, our moodiness. We have a reason for this now. Our passive aggressiveness. Or they can be used as a justifiable reason for our depression that we're not interested in getting out of, because depression brings sympathy. And not all depression is like this. I'm not painting it all with the same brush. But for some people, it's a useful tool to justify depression. These hurts and offenses can also be used to draw people towards us in sympathy, when that's useful. And they can be used to drive people away from us when that's useful, because they just don't understand our feelings. They just aren't showing sufficient support. If reconciliation is ever going to take place, this person might think, who holds on to the hurt feelings, then you want to arrive at that moment with all the baggage in hand. You don't want to forget the details. You don't want to be in a position where you can say, I can't remember exactly what happened, but let's just forget about it. Let's talk about it. You want to remember all the details. You want to make sure that they understand all the weight you've been carrying around all these days, months, years. The problem here is that you'll never be free of that hurt, that anger or pain, so long as you're waiting for that grand moment to arrive. The perpetrator has a backstage pass into your mind, and your mind is open to them 24/7. It's like being free on a very, very long chain. And you can circle around a long way on this chain. You can stretch pretty far back in a straight line, but at any given moment, you could be snapped back to that time and place, and the one snapping you back is the very person who hurt you in the first place. The one that you have given permission to be in your mind. You gave control of your happiness to someone else and your peace. Does it affect the person if you're wallowing in misery because of what they did? Crying your eyes out, reliving the moment over and over again? Not at all. Does it affect the other person if you let it go and are able to sleep soundly with peace of mind, knowing that you made a choice to control your own happiness? No. But both of these approaches affect you. So which one do you want to choose? I want to close on a positive note. Letting go of our wrath strengthens our relationships, in particular, our relationships within the church in this context. Doing so is an act of holiness. It's not just interpersonal relationships. It's not just human behavior. This is holiness. Those who release their anger, their hostility, are letting go of the reason and the source for war and division. In other words, they're acting as peacemakers. I want to close with the encouraging words of James chapter 3, verses 17 to 18. This is from the Message. You've probably heard these words before, but I want to end with this to leave you something to think about. Real wisdom, God's wisdom, begins with a life of holiness and is characterized by getting along with others. It is gentle. It is reasonable, overflowing with mercy and blessings to others, including our enemies. Not hot one day and cold the next, not two-faced. You can develop a healthy, robust community. Isn't that what a church is supposed to be? A church congregation? A church denomination? The whole one church? You can develop a healthy, robust community that lives right with God and enjoys its results only if you do the hard work of getting along with each other, treating each other with dignity and honor.